Welcome back to another episode of Highly Conflicted. With us this week is Katie Fang, host of The Katie Fang Show on MSNBC. And for this week's Inside Track on Trump World, January 6th comes back to haunt Trump in the final stretch of the presidential election race. And without any other celebrity endorsements, Trump pretends he got a Wall Street CEO to back him. This week, January 6th returned to the campaign trail for the first time in a while. First, it came up at the vice presidential debate between J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, when J.D. Vance refused to admit that Trump lost the 2020 election and then claimed that the Capitol attack on January 6th was peaceful. But then the federal judge overseeing Trump's criminal case over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election also got involved when she largely unsealed the special counsel's brief that detailed the scope of their case and why it should all proceed to trial if Trump loses in November. And to drive the point home on the campaign trail, Kamala Harris did a joint rally with Liz Cheney on Thursday, the vice chair of the House January 6th committee in the battleground state of Wisconsin. And that campaign event was notable because the Harris campaign has struggled to make January 6th an election at all in this cycle, in the way that it was in 2022 for the midterms, when the January 6th committee was wrapping up its findings and we had a number of MAGA Republicans running for congressional seats across the nation. So let's start this week with the Jack Smith filing, because it introduced new allegations and laid out the evidence that the special counsel's office wants to use if the case proceeds to trial. And I've reported at theguardian.com that the emphasis has been on Mike Pence, as well as Trump's efforts to influence state elected officials. And Katie, this is something we have talked about for an extremely long time, about the scope of the case. And Katie, of course, today is joined by Lucky, who's having a good time in the background.
He's so excited that he gets to be on Highly Conflicted, even as ambiance for you right now, that he's squeaking his toy in joy. Sorry. He'll make a cameo, I promise.
That's okay. Lucky actually has spent so much time around us and talking about Jack Smith that he probably knows more than most. But the thing that struck me about Mike Pence is the sorts of evidence that Jack Smith has, including things like Mike Pence directly telling Trump himself that he lost the election. They were talking about electoral prospects and how all of their conversations that the special counsel's office wants to use is couched as Trump being a candidate for office, as opposed to it acting in his function as president, which is designed to get around the Supreme Court's immunity ruling. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, and to be more specific, the way that Jack Smith has figured out the end run around the Supreme Court immunity decision vis-a-vis the Mike Pence stuff is to say that the two of them were running mates. That is the phrase that Jack Smith deploys to make sure that he doesn't have to worry about it. Because remember, Hugo, that immunity ruling explicitly addressed the Mike Pence communications. And they are presumptively immune, as in Trump does not get, you know, prosecuted for that component, the evidence that's associated with that component of Mike Pence, unless Jack Smith can successfully rebut that presumption of immunity. And so one of the ways to look at it, I think, is buckets. I'm a big fan of buckets. So you have the one bucket, Hugo, of straight absolute criminal immunity from prosecution. And that's for official acts and conduct committed by Donald Trump within even the outer perimeter, right, of his role as president of the United States. So that's one bucket. And it's a pretty big bucket if you're Donald Trump, I think, considering the way that this immunity ruling came out from SCOTUS. Then you kind of have an intermediary bucket, which is you presumptively have immunity, but it's a rebuttable presumption if Jack Smith can show that it wasn't official conduct, it wasn't within the perimeter or even the outer perimeter of your role as president. And that is things like the communications with Mike Pence that don't deal with the certification exclusively, right? That deal with them as running mates, talking about the fact that they both lost. Because remember, it's a two-man ticket. It's not just Donald Trump hanging out on his own. It's a two-man ticket. So if you and I, Hugo, are running for office, which maybe we will, you know, spoiler alert, maybe there's a Lowell Fang ticket in the near future. Are you even old enough to run for president? I just need to know, Hugo. I don't know if you are.
I don't know. Is that a minimum age? It would be news to me. But
whatever, young.
I wouldn't want to run and actually be all the establishment Democrats and Republicans at the same time. I'd be an independent ticket.
Well, I can't run with you if you're an independent ticket. But anyway, so then you have the last bucket, which is wholesale. What Jack Smith says is the entirety of his superseding indictment, which is private conduct by a private citizen, as in citizen Trump, candidate Trump. And the case that gets cited to repetitively by Jack Smith in this motion for immunity determinations, this 165-page filing, is Blassing Game, which is a case that we've heard argued and discussed, not only, you know, in the Supreme Court, but we've read it and we now see it again. It's this idea that you, if you're a candidate for office, you are a private acting individual. And so Jack Smith put it all on the line here. And it's because he knows that this is really his kind of one shot that he gets with Chutkan at this point. And I think he has a very sympathetic ear. But the Mike Pence stuff did take up a lot of space. Now, again, this is a 165-page filing. The first 85 pages is fact intensive. But then after a little bit of section two, which is some argument, you get into the remaining sections, which kind of weaves the law with argument and the facts. And so I think that the Mike Pence stuff is important, Hugo, but it doesn't have to stand alone. Like if the Mike Pence stuff gets cut out or knocked out successfully by Trump, you still have independent communications with private officials, state officials, private counsel, private attorneys. I mean, you have these conversations that show that Donald Trump knew that he lost that 2020 election.
Okay, so let's get into it a little bit, especially with the Section 2, Section 3 parts of the special counsel's filing, because it really gets into what sort of evidence Jack Smith, A, wants to put forward at trial and whether or not he will be able to, right? Because this will go to Judge Chutkan in the first instance. Trump will obviously appeal, it will go to the DC circuit, and ultimately it is almost certain to end up back at the Supreme Court. So if we think about the analysis a little bit, the way that Jack Smith laid this out was to say, to your point, all of the conduct in the superseding indictment and that we have rehashed here is getting overcomes the official act requirement, A, because this was Trump acting as a candidate, and B, even if we don't prove that, we can show that prosecuting these allegations would not infringe upon the functioning of the executive branch. It's a two-pronged argument, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So, first of all, Trump's lawyers are going to look at this and say, well, actually, all of its official conduct, and Trump was always acting in his capacity as president because he was, it all came
because
within
the... Because he was president at the time, right?
Because he was president.
Exactly.
That would be it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they will reference the take care clause in the Constitution that says, you know, the president has to take, ensure that elections are free of interference,
fraud. Exactly.
And they will say that blanket covers everything and all of these things are presumptively immune. If that succeeds, and who knows whether or not the John Roberts Supreme Court will buy that or not, but let's say they do buy that and we come to the fallback argument for the special counsel, which is to say prosecuting these things will not infringe upon the functioning of the executive branch. I do wonder if the Supreme Court will look at that and think, maybe these things are tied together and we just allow Trump's arguments to go through. Because if I'm Trump's lawyers, right, I look at this and go, Trump was acting in his capacity as president. He was trying to ensure that the election outcomes in these battleground states were all fine and above board, and you know he thought there was legitimate complaints or concerns about fraud and he wanted them investigated, which is why he didn't want Congress to certify, for instance, on January 6th, right? That's the kind of framework they will think about. And in order to do that, the moment you start questioning Trump's mindset as president or second guessing the president's intentions and actions, you infringe upon the functioning of the executive branch, because if Trump is prosecuted, a future president might go, oh no, the Supreme Court's going to challenge the way I'm thinking, and I don't want to be held in that position, and that would chill a president from taking decisive action. Do you think that's strong?
Well, if I'm Trump world, I'm going to think it's strong, but herein lies the rub, and herein lies the problem for Trump world. If that was the case, Hugo, the Supreme Court of the United States would have wholesale said and ruled absolute criminal immunity, never any questioning, never any analysis, never any evidentiary kind of deep dive. Right? Because even though the Supreme Court, the ruling reads as if that is the case, it's really not. Because remember, they sent it back for the purpose of the creation of an evidentiary record. Why would you need an evidentiary record if the Supreme Court is thinking or holding that or considering that the president of the United States, we can never really get into this, especially with Trump, the teeny little mind of that man. So the reason why Trump has a problem, Hugo, is I understand that the take care clause gives Trump some cover to say that he was making sure that there were fair and free elections in the United States in 2020. But consider the fact that now the evidence shows that even before November, there were already plans by Trump to declare that he was the winner regardless of the outcome. That's a major problem, one. And two, I think it's fair to allow the fact finder, i.e. the jury, to determine whether the source of the information, a la your Kenneth Chesbros, your Jeffrey Clarks, those people, right? Well, though Jeffrey Clark is kind of, you know, a carve out now, but I think considering the source of the information that was being relied upon by Donald Trump was those people, despite the fact that Trump was given evidence by reliable sources that he had lost, including his vice president at the time, right? Or more accurately, his running mate. I think the fact finder, as in the jurors, they get to decide whether or not there was obstruction, whether or not there was a crime that was committed. Again, I don't think that the Supreme Court intended on giving any president, let alone Donald Trump, the ability to escape liability wholesale. Because if that were the case, they would have written him a blank check back then. I also think...
Well, the cynic in me would say, you know, this was just... The Supreme Court's ruling on immunity was the precursor to the blank check, and it bought Trump time, and it laid out how the Roberts Court interpreted it, which was they didn't really want Trump to be prosecuted at all. They thought the indictment was too broad. You know, that's just my cynical kind of personal view. We don't, you know, this is not reporting based. This is just our interpretation. And I don't know. I feel like the more I look at the ruling and think about how it might be applied, I can increasingly envision a way for the court to decide. For instance, you know, you raise this thing about Trump deciding pre-election that he was going to call the results false and fraudulent and not accept it and just declare win anyway. Yeah. But let's say, but I take that point. Why couldn't the Trump lawyers then say, fine, leave that in, you can take that to trial, but you can't take all of the conversations afterwards about him talking to his vice president, him talking to Bill Barr, him talking to other White House officials or people adjacent to him saying that he had lost the election? Because isn't it in the president's prerogative to talk to whoever he likes? And if he thinks someone's advice is wrong, he doesn't have to follow it. That's what presidents do. They listen to other people.
But the ruling, Hugo, allowed for those conversations with the DOJ to be excluded, right? But when you look at what Jack Smith did and you look at the Bill Barr section of the Jack Smith motion, he says Bill Barr went on national television and other media outlets and said that there was no election fraud, and he did it without consultation with Donald Trump. So remember, the immunity runs to the president only. The immunity doesn't run to people outside of the presidency, right? And so Bill Barr, independent of Donald Trump, made a declaration that there was no election fraud. So why would what Bill Barr said from an evidentiary standpoint be excluded? Why? And why wouldn't a juror be able to rely upon that as a basis to determine whether or not Donald Trump knew or should have known at that time, right, that there was no election fraud?
Public statements, I grant you that. I I'm in agreement with something like that.
Okay.
I'm just trying to, you know, and in this exercise that we do, you know, you and I, it's like I'm always trying to have a sense of where Trump world might go to have a, you know, to have a sense of how this might play out. And while I feel like something like that is untouchable, I can see the Trump lawyers trying to make a big meal out of, say, someone like Eric Hirschman. You know, this came up in the recent Jack Smith filing. Eric Hirschman, they go into a long discussion in the filing about how he was a longtime friend of Jared, how he had this hybrid role of White House, one of the White House counsels, but also an informal advisor who was a conduit to their campaign and played this sort of hybrid role. And Eric Hirschman was telling Trump, obviously, and Trump world that Trump had lost. But to me, I can see the Trump lawyers making an argument that someone like Eric Hirschman, whose testimony the special counsel's office relies on in a big way as well, by the way, as did the January 6th committee, but he would fall into the category of like an informal White House advisor. And if you start prosecuting Trump or former presidents based on their conversations with informal advisors, that might have a chilling effect on the executive branch.
In what capacity? Because if the guy's a, quote, informal White House advisor, he's not a part of the government, right? He's not a part of the executive branch. He's not a part of the DOJ. He's not a part of even any department or any type of, you know, part. He's not a part of anything of the administration, right? So why is there immunity for that?
The Trump lawyers say because you're chilling the president to seek counsel from anyone and to do that confidentially to make up his mind. You know, for instance, if it was the Bush White House and Bush was relying on an informal advisor to say, you know, what should we do about, I don't know, the CIA's torture program and any decisions I make based on our discussions, I want that to remain confidential so that I'm not chilled in the future from having these informal candid conversations. I mean, that has been the basic understanding of executive privilege for a very long time. And that has also been the understanding or the reasoning that goes into speech or debate clause that protects members of Congress's communications as well. And I think there is room for the Trump lawyers to make that sort of argument. I think ultimately it would be unsuccessful, but I also see that potentially carving out chunks of the superseding indictment.
Well, I think the problem would be, though, again, that the Supreme Court could have, like it did in the original immunity ruling, say that the absolute criminal immunity bucket includes informal advisors to the president of the United States. What would have stopped them from doing it months ago in July when they issued that immunity ruling? They made sure that they included explicitly in that ruling that the immunity extends to conversations with people that are in the DOJ, for example, right? I mean, they made sure that they included certain people. So why not include any and all informal advisors to the executive office of the president of the United States? They didn't do that. I actually think Trump's stronger argument is one that they've already raised, which is the allowing of testimony to the grand jury concerning things like Mike Pence and communications with Mike Pence, et cetera, quote, taints the entirety of the indictment. And that is the reason why the indictment should be dismissed. Right.
But that's an easy fix. That's an easy fix for Jack Smith, right? He just goes back to the grand jury without that tainted evidence and re-indicts it with a superseding indictment or otherwise.
But there's a cart and a horse problem here, though, right? The cart and the horse problem is this. Go back to the grand jury based upon what determination, right? So you realize we're at the stage where we're post-grand jury. We're now post-superseding indictment, right? And so if you're Trump and you're saying that those conversations with Mike Pence are not rebuttably, presumably now not immune or, you know, whatever, they are immune and Judge Chutkan agrees with you. So then what happens then? I mean, I guess the reason why this becomes so complicated and messy, courtesy of the Supreme Court, is There's no true path that was provided by that ruling to explain how we get there. So I can see this being like a piecemeal appeals process, which is what Chutkan and the DOJ has said they wanted to avoid. They wanted to avoid repetitive appeals that are happening here. And I think that Chutkan's going to do the best that she can do to be able to not fall into that trap. I think if you strip away, let's just say, Mike Pence conversations, you strip away Bill Barr stuff, Trump has a serious problem with the fake elector scheme conversations.
So let's get to that.
So that's really important, you know?
That's the second part that, you know, we identified as being a major part of the superseding indictment and the filing is Trump's pressure campaign on state elected officials in order to get them to decertify the votes in those battleground states. And this was, I think, a very smart play from the special counsel when they wrote in the brief that it couldn't be that Trump was exercising the take care clause as president, because in every single phone call,
he has no role. But back up, Hugo. He has no role in the certification of the elections in the states. He has no role.
But right. But let's just leave that aside for a minute, because I just thought this was a incredibly smart argument, which was every phone call that Trump made with every state official was about his race. He was calling as a candidate for the presidential race. Every fraudulent claim was to do with the top of the ticket,
not down ballot.
There were
races.
All these down ballot races down the back for the governors, for the gubernatorial races, for the congressional races, and he never once raised those. And so the frame of mind very, very clearly was that Trump was focused on his own race
as candidate Trump, not as President Trump.
The preemptive argument, I think, that argument has not been made explicitly before, as far as I have seen.
It has not been made in any, I don't think, any arguments or filings that you and I have covered vis-a-vis this case or even the other cases.
And I think that actually preempts anything that Trump could say about the take care clause, because that evidence is irrefutable.
Well, and remember, too, the other thing that Jack Smith was smart enough to do in this filing was something that I noted, which was Jack Smith used evidentiary findings from the Mark Meadows removal proceedings. So remember, to all you guys tuning in to Highly Conflicted with Hugo Lowell, Mark Meadows tried to remove his Fulton County state court prosecution in Georgia to federal court, arguing that that was the proper place, the proper venue, the proper jurisdiction to be able to prosecute him. And in so doing, Mark Meadows took the stand, took an oath to tell the truth, and testified in front of a federal judge who then made factual findings that are currently up on appeal. But the factual findings that were reached made the conclusion for that judge, Judge Jones, in Georgia, in federal court, that what Meadows did as chief of staff for Donald Trump at the time, vis-a-vis those phone calls, the Brad Raffensperger, like, find me 11,780 votes, all of that, that was not official duty on the part of the chief of staff of Donald Trump, right? And so Trump has a problem, because each of those fake elector state prosecutions that are happening, et cetera, there's independent evidence of stuff going on in those places that Jack Smith uses, and you can see it. It's laid out in this immunity motion, right? And so it's all there. And so Trump has a problem. And so if we're going to go down this path, Hugo, which you and I do all the time, of what's left, like, where do we go with this? It's bad for Donald Trump. Even if you don't have the DOJ conversations and you don't have the Mike Pence conversations, if you just have the fake elector stuff, that was always the plan, right? The plan by him was the great, you know, rollout of the fake elector scheme, courtesy of the architect of this, which was Ken Chesbro. Footnote, who's cooperating like a bitch everywhere, right? I mean, right. He is running his mouth everywhere. And so there's stuff he's saying that we don't even know that he's saying in these state court cases. So I don't know. You know, I feel like I would not be so confident if I'm Donald Trump that the Supreme Court is going to save me, especially considering Amy Coney Barrett's position, which is fake elector schemes do not get presidential immunity.
Yeah, and Jack Smith specifically pointed to Amy Coney Barrett's dissent in his brief as he got into the fake elector stuff. And actually, while you're talking about that, it made me think of all of the three charges, all of the three conspiracies that the special counsel has charged in this case. All three of them can be buttressed in multiple ways by the fake elector scheme.
Yeah. You know,
for instance, the 18 U.S.C. 1512, the obstruction of an official proceeding charge, even though that has been narrowed to crimes that are related to document tampering or document obstruction, the fake elector certificates still fit that role. If you think about the other conspiracies, about conspiracy against rights to defraud millions of Americans and their votes,
yeah,
again, the fake
them.
Elector yeah. scheme fits that bill as well. Across all of the conspiracies that Trump has been charged with, all you need, perhaps, to bring the case is the fake elector scheme. And I don't know how the Trump team can get around that, even if they manage to excise the Mike Pence thing, or the other White House officials, or the other conversations that took place with Eastman. Because as strong as those things are, you can still bring the case based on the fake elector scheme.
Well, and I would note for your listeners/viewers that Trump just filed a supplement to his motion to dismiss post Fisher, post the obstruction of an official proceeding Supreme Court ruling that narrowed that federal statute to
just
only
documents.
Contemplate documents, not what we saw on January 6th, which was the storming of the Capitol, right? Like that was not included or now contemplated to be included in the obstruction statute. But even though they're trying to get that dismissed on behalf of Donald Trump, to your point, the fake elector certificates, the transmission of fake documents, et cetera, that's your obstruction. That's the core of the obstruction, right? It's the convening of these people that were not legitimate state electors, you know, certifying something fake and then trying to get it to DC and trying to get it to Mike Pence to get him to do it. I mean, I think what happens is you may get a narrower superseding indictment, right? You may get something that's a little bit thinner, but it's never going to be 100% gone. And I mean, I'll take advantage of this one kind of, you know, related moment to say that's why the vote in November is so important. We've said time and time again, Donald Trump isn't running to be the president of the United States. He's running to stay out of prison. But if he succeeds to get back into the Oval Office, this DC January 6th election interference prosecution will be gone, as will any attempts to revive a classified documents prosecution in Florida, right? And so I just think if this gets to the Supreme Court, any appeal, it may get thinned out, but it'll never wholesale go away. And Donald Trump knows that.
And the big problem, and I've explained this to the Trump lawyers, and there is a general sort of agreement on this, is of all of the conspiracies, and I'd be interested to get your take, the obstruction charge to me seems to be the one that will always be a colossal problem for Trump. And that's because the obstruction statute has four parts, and the last part talks about the defendant acting corruptly in order to gain a corrupt benefit. And of course, the crux of this case and the crux of the conspiracy is that the corrupt benefit is the presidency himself. When Trump was taking all of these steps to ensure that whether it was Mike Pence or any of the states certified Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 election, it was all in order for him to achieve the corrupt benefit of not giving up the presidency, for him to stay in the Oval Office. And when you think about the obstruction charge like that, I think it's very difficult to escape from that allegation. It's as clear as it's written. There is a corrupt benefit that Trump was trying to obtain. And I don't know how the Trump lawyers get out of that mens rea problem either.
Well, and that actually dovetails perfectly with what you pointed out, which is any attempts by Donald Trump to, quote unquote, take care that the laws of our country are being, you know, fairly and correctly applied and that there are fair and free elections, whatever, you pointed out a few moments ago, it was only for him. He wasn't checking to make sure that there was voter fraud in Fulton County because of the gubernatorial race or, you know, the dog catcher, right? Like, that's not what he was worried about. And again, if you kind of bootstrap that with Tina Peters going to prison, you know, for her role in allowing voter fraud and tampering with ballots, and stuff, I mean, it's an insult to the intelligence of any juror to suggest that the reason why Trump was doing this was because he had a fear that there was voter fraud if the only person he cared about was candidate Trump. So I think the only saving grace that Trump could get is the only surviving carve out, I think, Hugo, from this decision would be that the president gets total immunity in every way, and the only person who could be prosecuted would be a candidate for office who was not who was not the incumbent president at the time. I mean, I'm trying to think of who that criminal defendant could end up being, considering what we've seen and what we know. It would have to be, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, this whole thing doesn't make sense, right? I mean, if that's the case, then it would be a standard criminal prosecution of any candidate for office, right? It would be irrelevant, you know? So it would mean that you could never prosecute an incumbent president.
Right.
It's not even, it's almost like you can't even, it's not even you can't prosecute a president. You can't prosecute an incumbent president who happens to be running for office again, right? It's just this weird kind of nuance to it. And it's like a weird kind of, I feel like really, this, it just goes to underscore how horrible the Supreme Court decision was. We've bemoaned how bad it is, but now that we've seen it in practical application, it just makes it seem like it's so much shittier than we knew that it was.
But that being said, so our conclusion, our takeaway is, regardless of what gets stripped out, there is a very, very good chance that the fake elector scheme will always remain, no matter what Trump's lawyers try. And in that instance, all three charges, all three conspiracies against Trump are still ready to go because it implicates all of them. And I think that's kind of an important thing for people to understand.
And to put a finer point on our entire conversation we've had, I want to kind of clean this up a little bit, if I may. So there has to be an immunity determination at the get-go before the case then proceeds, right? But a lot of what you and I have been talking about for the last, 20 minutes or so, Hugo, has been the evidence in this case, right? In order to move forward with an indictment, the indictment has to be considered as kind of like an entire creature, right? But the indictment has four offenses or four charges. Trump is trying to get them all knocked out, but some of those four could survive. The next part of the analysis, courtesy of the Supreme Court's immunity ruling, is what evidence survives, right, to be able to be used by the government. And so even now, you and I have kind of been swimming in this murky water because we've been talking about the evidence, Hugo, but you don't even get to the evidence until you actually deal with what charges survive on a motion to dismiss. And that's why it's been so messy, because Trump didn't want, remember, Trump didn't want special counsel Jack Smith to be able to file this in the first place. He fought tooth and nail to make sure that this didn't happen. And Chutkan said, no, I'm letting this happen. Now, I also want to remind people that Judge Chutkan just yesterday entered an order that said to Donald Trump, you can file your response to this immunity determination motion of Jack Smith's, and it can be up to 180 pages. And she gave him more time to be able to file it. She didn't give him as much time as he asked for, but she gave him more time to be able to do it. Now, it's after our November election, right? It's after that date. But I just want to kind of like I said, I want to clean this up a little bit, Hugo. I want to make sure that people understand that there is criminal procedure, right? There is a procedure in this case where it's an indictment and applicable motions. But because the Supreme Court thought it was being so cute by half, right? Trying to be so cute by half by creating this immunity ruling, Judge Chutkan says, well, look, You're the ones who sent it back to me saying that I have to make an initial determination as to immunity. And you also sent it back to me saying that I had to do it based upon evidentiary submission. So here we go. So don't complain, Donald Trump, that I'm allowing this evidentiary submission by special counsel Jack Smith, because how else am I supposed to decide whether these charges stick or they don't?
Right.
I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think it does. And it actually perfectly segues into the next part of what happened this week, which is with J.D. Vance and his moment on the debate stage with Tim Walz. So if we pivot slightly to the political implications of January 6th, that was a bad moment for J.D. In an otherwise solid performance, I think objectively from J.D. Vance, where he in many ways sane washed the rough edges of Trump's, you know, platform for a second term, that was a bad moment that stuck out in particular when Tim Walz looked over at J.D. Vance and said, the fact that you cannot answer that question, that the 2020 election was lost by Donald Trump, that was a damning response.
It wasn't even that he couldn't answer it. He just didn't answer it. J.D. Vance kept on saying, I'm looking to the future. I'm looking to the future, which was a BS way of addressing this issue. I mean, it wasn't just the only question that was posed by the moderators that J.D. Vance refused to answer. Let's be clear. And the S word you use, I think you said it was solid. Is that, I think, the adjective you used? No, I think the adjective we kept on hearing was slick, right?
But I wrote slick. That's true. That was my
slick
word.
Yeah. Right? And I think my colleague, Rachel Maddow, actually put it perfectly, which is you can kind of dress up a lie, but it's still a lie. Like, you can make a lie look and sound appealing, but it's still a lie at its core. And that is the problem for J.D. Vance. The stuff he was saying wasn't true through and through. But the through line of all of this week has been the VP debate with the January 6th refusal of J.D. Vance to acknowledge the January 6th violence. And by the way, it wasn't just his refusal to acknowledge that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election, but the fact that he had the audacity to say that there was a peaceful transfer of power on January 20th was a slap in the face of all Americans. I don't care what your political affiliation
is. And let's just remind everyone what actually happened that day, which was Trump broke the tradition of every president before him and did not go to the Capitol
for the inauguration.
For the what is arguably, in my opinion, the most symbolic part of the peaceful transfer of power, which is to see the outgoing president and the incoming president and the first families together at the Capitol on the inauguration platform, and that symbolizing the transfer of power. For what actually happened, of course, was Trump took the motorcade to Joint Base Andrews. He got on his private plane, flew to Mar-a-Lago with his boxes of classified documents
that he was stealing from the White House.
Which is a separate episode for another time. But
he's a child. He's a petulant child. He's immature. He took his toys that didn't belong to him, by the way. He took his toys that he wanted to sell on the market. Yeah, he stole other people's toys, more accurately. And he ran away like a child does, like a toddler does when you tell them that they've done something wrong. But he didn't show up. And then it was not even two weeks after, you know, he, you know, encouraged, if not himself, wanted to march on the capital of the United States. I mean, and then you have that VP debate on Tuesday. You then have this Jack Smith filing drop the next day, right? And it deals with January 6th and election interference. And then you have Liz Cheney standing there next to Kamala Harris in Ripon, Wisconsin, endorsing Kamala Harris and saying that the reason why she, as in Liz Cheney, endorses Kamala Harris is because they both believe in the defense of our United States Constitution and they understand and respect our Constitution, unlike Donald Trump. I mean, that is one of the most, I think, powerful through lines you're ever going to see in this race to decision 2024. Just those 72 hours of that debate, the Jack Smith filing and the Liz Cheney endorsement and the rally with Kamala Harris with country over party, that's what I think changes people's minds when you kind of have it. It's not even a 1-2 punch, right? It's even more so. And I think people need to be reminded of that, but for, And it's funny because I had this conversation with somebody the other day. I'm like, you know, Donald Trump's so stupid. If he had never run for office, he would never be looking at the stuff that you and I are talking about, right? I mean, maybe not. Never say never. I mean, it would not have stopped, you know, other people from maybe bringing civil litigation. It would not have stopped Attorney General Letitia James from doing what she did, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff there. I'm just saying his running for office brought him so much more scrutiny and heightened attention, and it drew attention
to the things he would rather keep hidden, right?
Yeah, and then in the end, perhaps the biggest thing he did, even though the layup prosecution we've always said is the classified documents case, right? But then remember, you wouldn't have the classified documents case if he had never been president of the United States, right? Because he never would have had access to those documents. But putting aside the classified documents case, it's this case, the DC case, the January 6th election interference case, is the most damning of all of them because it was the one that was the most egregious against the Constitution, right? Against all our institutions and our norms was this particular case. And it's because he was, at the time, president of the United States.
And the joint rally with Cheney was really extraordinary for multiple reasons, but I think it was also the first time that someone as ideologically conservative as Liz Cheney has A, rallied with the Democratic nominee for president, B, endorsed the Democratic nominee for president, and C, is trying to bring other conservatives into the fold on the promise that protecting the Constitution and liberal democracy is more important than your policies.
They, as in Kamala Harris and Liz Cheney, could not be more diametrically opposed when it comes to policies. But what we saw was the country over party principle, which makes sense. And even Liz Cheney said it herself, right? There comes a time when, even though you may disagree with someone, the thing that binds you together is the respect for the institutions of the rule of law, which has been decimated and destroyed by Donald Trump. Our friend Molly Jong Fast said, and I agree with this, you know, Liz Cheney doing what she's done, Adam Kissinger, Dick Cheney, I mean, you name certain, you know, conservative Republicans, it's a permission structure, right? It's allowing people to feel like it's okay for them to vote outside of their party, which before was never scandalous, but frowned upon, or maybe something that you didn't do. But I think now, I think party labels have become a thing of the past in some ways, because a lot of people don't vote their party anymore. And I think by having somebody like Liz Cheney say, I and my father, I mean, Dick Cheney endorsing Kamala Harris. We didn't hear a lot about that last night because it was Liz Cheney's moment. You stop and you think about it, it really makes you want to fall out of your chair, right? And so when you consider
the 2012, the 2008 person could not comprehend what is going on in 2024.
It's not even the 2008. I mean, it's like, I think somebody said too, we've been dealing with Donald Trump bullshit for almost 10 years now. I mean, I don't mean to depress people, but 2015 was the launch, right, of the campaign, et cetera, for him for 2016. I mean, we're about to hit 10 years of dealing with Donald Trump bullshit, and people are exhausted, but they have enough energy left and enough drive and enough concern about making sure that we're okay to get out and vote the right way in November. And so, I don't know, it's just, again, that through line of January 6th this week, I think has been really incredible. And what, we're 32 days now? 32 days away from the election.
Well, our final topic, because the BS has not stopped. This week, Trump reposted a screenshot on Truth Social that claimed Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, had endorsed him. As it turned out, that was not true.
Not true.
And a spokesperson for JP Morgan confirmed Dimon has made no endorsement and has not endorsed any candidate. But this got me thinking about the wider issue for Trump, which was also apparent in the wake of Taylor Swift endorsing Kamala Harris, which is Trump is coming into this final stretch of the election with really few big name endorsements. I mean, you're really looking at Elon Musk, a number of tech bros, and that's about it. There is no cultural social figure.
You forgot Kid Rock. You don't want Kid Rock?
Well, it's funny you say that, because every time you raise this to people in Trump's orbit, the Trump people like to say, well, Trump's following is actually bigger than that of Taylor Swift, so it doesn't really matter if Taylor Swift doesn't endorse him,
That's
which is kind of
bullshit.
Such a cop-out answer.
That's such BS. Are you
but
kidding me?
But it does speak
me?
To a wider issue of how he does not have big-name celebrities endorsing him, and the kind of impact, the adverse impact it may have on him with respect to turnout, because this will be a close election, and in close elections, it's all about turnout.
Yeah, I mean, you and I talk about the fake elector schemes, et cetera, in different states. And think about Georgia, for example, right? How many votes did he say he was demanding to get? 11,780, right? Maybe it was 789, I don't know. The point is, it's not like he was saying, find me 200,000 votes, find me 500,000 votes. I mean, 11,000 votes.
It's tiny.
It's tiny in the grand scheme, right? If you think about it, that is, you know, 100 people in how many different places, right? You're the math guy. But the point is, like, it is enough of a margin to win. And you and I could do a whole other pod episode on the Electoral College, because I think that's an important conversation that needs to be had. Popular vote, Electoral College. But I think when it comes to endorsements, you know, there's different schools of thought, right? A lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, that doesn't mean anything. Clearly, that's Trump world saying it doesn't mean anything. But the Taylor Swift endorsement, though, hey, Lucky, the Taylor Swift endorsement, though, it's the youth vote, right? It's such horse caca for Trump to say that he doesn't want the youth vote, or he doesn't
want
to be able
to get
that. If
he could get it, he would want
that.
It. He's just shitting
of
on it
course,
because he doesn't have it.
Because he doesn't have it, which is, again, him acting like a petulant child and not getting what he wants. It's just, you know, the man could slink off into the sunset and nobody would be sad to see him go. But he persists in the wrong way to stick around. It's like, you know, it's like the lingering fart in a room. We all know it came from him, and he's going to pretend like, you know, it's not him. Nobody wants him around, and it's bizarre that he cannot take a hint and he cannot leave. That part I don't understand, but he'll get his packing. Was his packing orders? He'll get his marching orders shortly. Here's Lucky trying to knock down the computer.
Well, that's the show. That's it for Highly Conflicted with me, Hugo Lowell. This week we had Katie Fang on. See you next week.
Bye.